From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with writer Ved Mehta. Mehta has written a series of autobiographical books about growing up in his native India, losing his sight at the age of 4, and coming to live in America as a young man. Also today, I talk with writer Michael Ignatieff. His new book, The Russian Album, is a portrait of his grandparents, who were nobility in Tsarist Russia. It forced him to reflect on how our knowledge of our inherited past influences who we are in the present. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new reissue of the 1959 album Ellington Jazz Party, as well as a controversial new biography of Duke Ellington. And TV critic David Bianculli continues his preview of the new fall season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is Ved Mehta, who is continuing a series of autobiographical books that he began in 1972. It's rather like being an archaeologist of oneself, he once said. Although his autobiographies explore many turning points of childhood, adolescence, and adulthood, which we all can identify with, his personal story is quite uncommon. Mehta grew up in India. A case of meningitis left him blind at the age of 4. At 15, he came to America to study at a school for the blind in Arkansas. Initially, he was very disoriented in America, way out of the mainstream by virtue of being both blind and Indian. But he decided to settle in New York, where he now lives with his wife and child. The latest installment of Mehta's autobiography was published earlier this month in the New Yorker magazine, where his work has been published for many years. Norton Books is bringing out his whole series in paperback. They recently published the volume titled Vedi. Mehta has written 10 other books, including Portrait of India and a biography of Mahatma Gandhi. I spoke with Ved Mehta from the NPR studios in New York. Mehta has written, "I sometimes feel I am leading two lives, the life that I am remembering and interpreting, and my ordinary day-to-day life." I asked him if his current life is always affected by the one he's writing about.
Of course, because writing life is very much part of my real life. In other words, I spend 8-10 hours a day either writing or thinking about writing or worrying about writing. So obviously, in a sense, I'm always leading a double life, a life I'm remembering and documenting and reading over. When I set about the task of reconstructing my life, I usually go back to journals, to letters of the period, to land deeds, to account books, registers, whatever, anything that will jog my memory and will bring that period into focus. So, in a sense, I'm living in the past and present at the same time. By the way, I think that's much more normal in most people's lives that they probably know. I think all memory, by definition, is current. We only remember those things that have some bearing on our present life. I think the memory of real events probably doesn't exist as real events, if you see what I mean.
You've been blind since the age of 4, and I wonder if you remember sight at all, and if you have any memories of it that you feel help you in your writing or in your reading of other books.
Well, in conscious memory, I have no memory, because all conscious memory, by definition, depends on reinforcement. And, of course, I've had no reinforcement since I was 4. But surely in my unconscious, those memories must be there. If Freud is to be believed, the earliest years are the most determining years. And surely, somewhere in my head, all those memories are there. I do believe that Freud is right, that nothing that happens to us from the moment we separate from mother's body, from our mother's body, is lost. It's all there. So that's really all I can say about it. But I have no conscious evidence to which I can point.
Well, you know, I almost feel, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I almost feel like I know you intimately from having read some of your work, because you're so frank about what you experienced.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, but I should just warn you that writers have many personae.
Right.
Persona
right.
is a Latin word for mask, if I can be pedantic. And so we wear many masks. And of course, no matter how much we tell, there's always more to tell. And in a sense, by the very act of writing a book, you outgrow that self. And so it's a constant process of, as it were, changing skins. I do think that, although I don't set out to write confessions or anything like that, the attempt is to be as truthful, painful though it is, as I can possibly be, because otherwise I think there is really no reason to write autobiography. But I do have to say that no matter how truthful you are and how careful one is to be accurate, of course, this is life reconstructed. Like, or it's a literary life, and it's not the real life. I should just make one other point that which I started out with, that though it deals with memory, it's current memory, but I think there is something that I'm doing that's unusual. At least I don't know anybody else who's done it. Let me give you an example. I start to write Vedi, which covers really the period of my life from age 5 to 8. When I started writing it, I had no idea whether it would be a chapter in a book or a paragraph in a book, because when I asked myself, what do I remember between age 5 and 8? The answer was, well, not very much. But then I started asking myself, when I would sit down at my desk to write, now, wait a minute, where were you during those years? So how did you get there? Who did you know? Who did you care about? Do you remember any people? What were they doing? How did they affect you, or how did you relate to them? And through a process of association, a paragraph grew into a page into a chapter, and chapter eventually into a book. But here is what I'm talking about, doing something different. In addition to trying to remember, I also go, whenever it's possible, and interview the people whom I knew at the time.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your early life. After you went blind, your mother took you to several faith healers because she believed that you had a chance of regaining your sight. Was that a frightening experience to go to these faith healers? And did you think you'd ever get it back?
Well, I think that a denial mechanism is very strong in human psychology. We all try to deny unpleasant facts in every day of our lives. If you were to ask yourself the question, well, supposing if I were an ugly person, I would try to deny that I'm an ugly person because it would make life very difficult. That's the most obvious example. Now, here was a well-to-do family. I came from a well-to-do family in Indian terms, not by American terms. And blindness was an affliction which wasn't supposed to strike anybody who was well-to-do. It really was something associated with the poor, like leprosy. And I was one of seven children, and suddenly I lost my sight. At that time, I was one of six. And I'd lost my sight. Now, my mother was not a very educated person, and she was also a believer. We have instances of very educated believer who believe among, say, Catholics. There are certain relics in which they believe, or certain places. If you go, you might be healed. So she was taken in hand, or she allowed herself to be taken in hand by faith healers and quacks and charlatans of all kinds, whether they themselves believed that they had power to heal. Or maybe they didn't, but they were just trying to take advantage of her, I don't know. But, of course, my identification with my mother was so strong that if she believed that these horrible medicines that were put in my eyes or certain birch sticks that I was beaten with would cure me of the demons which had got into my brain and seized my optic nerve, and not that they would know optic nerve, but had taken away my sight, well, then I believed along with her. At the same time, I had a contrary influence in my father, who was actually a medical man. He was trained in the West, in Western medicine, who didn't have any faith because he knew that as a result of meningitis, my optic nerves had been damaged, and there was no way to restore them. So these healers were consulted behind his back, but when he did find out about them, he would tell me, "This is all nonsense. You have to make your life accepting the fact that you'll never be able to see, at least never be able to see insofar as we now know through modern medicine." So I was really torn between my mother's point of view and my father's, and there was times when I took my mother's side, other times when I took my father's.
Your father sent you to a school for the blind that was around 1,300 miles away from your home when you were 5 years old. And I think part of the reason why he did that is he wanted to make sure that you learned how to survive on your own. And I think he had visions of all the blind beggars in the streets of India and, you know, didn't want you ever to become that. Is that something that you ever worried about yourself, that if you didn't become self-sufficient, that was the alternative?
Yes, I absolutely did, because that was the only fate or lot of the blind people in India. India is such a poor country that there's so many people who just slip off the escalator of life and never get back on it.
Your father also suggested to you that at some point you should go to the West, you should go to America, because no Indian parents of your class and of your education would ever give their daughter to you in marriage.
Yes, well, he had been educated in England and America, and although he had vision of the blind beggars in India, he also knew that in the West there was another perspective on blindness, where someone like Roosevelt, who was paralyzed, could become the president. And so he took a a very Western outlook toward my handicap, and which is what we called it then. And I think I identified with him, and that became a kind of propelling impulse in my own life, that I myself wanted to get out of India and get to the West and see the see my blindness from a different perspective.
And I guess you also really wanted to excel and achieve so that you could become self-sufficient.
That's right. I think that's a goal of anybody, blind or not, to become independent and self-sufficient and effective citizens in their own right. But of course, if you are blind or paralyzed, the struggle becomes that much harder.
After you finished your education in India, you came to America and studied first at a school for the blind in Arkansas. And this happened at a time when you were a young man, so you were reaching manhood in a new country. Did it take you a long time to figure out the American conception of manhood?
Well, I was 15 when I came here. I don't know if I could have put it that way. I mostly saw it in these incredible terms of dating and going steady, all these terms, and the music. So that was the first experience I had of American life. For instance, I never knew there was such thing as divorce in the world. So all these were new experiences, and they had powerful effect, because at the same time I was having these powerful adolescent emotions of wanting to connect with somebody else, of wanting somebody to talk to, because although I'd been 1,300 miles away from India when I was between 5 and 8, but now I was 10,000 miles away, and there was no communication, really, verbal communication possible between anyone at home and Arkansas, and the two worlds were so different.
You must have really felt like an outsider, even when you were in a blind school, and being blind didn't set you apart from people. Being Indian must have. I'm sure you were.
I think I was the only Indian in Arkansas.
Yeah, right.
Right, of course. But at the same time, like all adolescents, I wanted to belong. And so while I internally felt outsider, outwardly I was trying to adjust and adapt and become just another Arkansas boy. I mean, that was my great aim.
In a couple of your books, you wrote about something called facial vision, and of something that you describe as sound shadows, ways in which people without sight can sense what's around them.
Right.
Could you describe a little bit what that is?
Yeah, it's really a system of echoes. It's no different. We have a country house in Maine, and I noticed that sailors there, when it's very foggy, blow a whistle, and they can tell by the sound of the whistle bouncing off rocks where exactly they are. It's the same system that blind people use when you're, say, clicking along the street. You can tell by the clicks whether you're near a wall or open space or coming up against a mailbox. I describe that in the book. I can't do it very briefly here, but basically it's trying to see the world through your ears, and that's how most of us avoid obstacles and learn to get around in streets, you know, travel by ourselves.
Did going to schools for the blind help you develop that sense?
Yes, because obviously somebody who understands the system and is expert, they are much better at training. In fact, I would say the best thing I got out of the school in Arkansas was learning what they call mobility. I already had facial vision. I used to ride a bicycle and so on. I couldn't have known what you called it. I just knew that if I were on a bicycle and coming very fast towards a lamppost or something, I could tell that I was approaching something. I couldn't tell what it was. But at this school, they helped me perfect it and gave me a conceptual framework, which then allowed me to move about streets and different states by myself.
I think when you started going to a mainstream school, Pomona College, that a lot of your fellow students wouldn't let you rely on your own sense.
Yeah, only in the beginning. I think when they first saw me going around, they couldn't imagine that I could just step off the curve and I would know when to get there or go up the stairs or run down a flight of stairs. But after I'd been there for a week or so, then everybody left me alone. But they couldn't, they always wondered how I did it. But certainly they got used to me and after a while just accepted me as one of them. I was in California, for 4 years? And I think after the first week or two or three, I was just taken as a normal student.
You always wanted to make sure that you could get around yourself without relying on a cane or a dog, and you've certainly been able to do that. But I wonder if it's gotten any harder in the past few years as cities have gotten more dangerous?
Oh, yes, it is. It is harder. For instance, Manhattan, where I live now, resembles a mining town. I used to walk home from my office on 43rd Street. I used to live on 82nd and 5th. And I would walk home in the evening just to get some exercise. And now I would be afraid to walk 2-3 blocks because there are scaffoldings, there are construction everywhere. There are machinery of one kind or another. So yes, it's become harder, but manageable.
Do you get around by yourself?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. I want to talk with you more.
By the way, different blind people have different degree of facial vision. It's like anything else in life. I happen to be endowed with perhaps more sensitivity than some other blind people, some people who become blind late in life have to use dogs, whereas I never needed to. But I'm glad that dogs are available for those who need them.
My guest is writer Ved Mehta, and his series of autobiographies is being released in paperback by Norton. The latest one to be published is called Vedi. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
The last installment of your autobiography was published recently in the New Yorker magazine, and it covers the period of your life where you went to Pomona College. What kind of research did you do to remember that?
Well, you know, because I was separated from my family by thousands of miles. I wrote them a letter practically every week. And I have all those, they saved those letters, they wrote me letters, then I was writing term papers, then I kept a journal. It was not a daily journal, but infrequent journal. Then I went back to Pomona and met some of the people and interviewed them. And the procedure was no different than the procedure I followed writing other volumes. The section you read in The New Yorker is a small section of a big book I'm doing on my college years in California.
It seems to me you've always been an outsider in your world, since your parents sent you to the School for the Blind at age four, been an outsider by virtue either of being blind or of being Indian while you were in America. Of course, you always ended up working your way in and becoming a part of things, but you'd always start as a real outsider. Now, I think all adolescents feel like outsiders, but in you it must have been so heightened. And I wonder if you think that that helped you in any way as a writer, since what writers do is stay on the outside and observe.
I think all artists are outsiders. There was a popular book written by Colin Wilson in the 50s called The Outsider, where he argued that all artists are outsiders. I don't know if I go that far. I don't know if Chaucer was an outsider, but or Shakespeare. But there's no question that in order to observe life, it helps you to be both an outsider and perhaps also to be insider. In other words, you always have little different perspective. If your perspective was the same as everybody else's, there'd be no point in writing anything or drawing a picture. There's something that sets us apart, and no matter how much insider I become, my mental life will always be that of an outsider.
You know, I think sometimes we like to think that people who've lost one sense are compensated by having another sense that's heightened. And I'm sure some people have asked you if you felt that your blindness has been compensated with your gift of perception, your gift as a writer. Have you thought about that at all?
Well, I've obviously thought about it, but I don't think it has been. I think the only compensation I've got is intelligence and hard work. But no, I don't think that there are many people who see, who hear just as well, if not better, who have perfect pitch, which I don't have. I don't think my fingers are any more sensitive than those of a typist who comes to me. No, I think my perceptions are pretty ordinary. My senses, but when it comes to my intellectual perceptions, they are heightened, but there are a lot of seeing people who have terrific intellectual perception. I don't think that has much to do with blindness.
Is this a romantic vision that you think people who are sighted have?
No, I think people like to console themselves if they see somebody who's walking along who can't see. They may feel sorry, but then if they can say to themselves, "Oh, but maybe he has great perception or hearing or something," it makes them feel better. But there is no psychological evidence for any of that. It's popular myth.
You have a position that many, many writers would envy. You're a staff writer for The New Yorker, and I think that's correct. You're a staff writer?
Well, yes, I don't know what that means exactly.
Right.
Basically, I'm a freelance writer who has a contract with The New Yorker to show them my things before I show them to anybody else. But it's a very loose arrangement. And so, I pretty much write what I want to and hope they will accept some of it.
You've been writing for The New Yorker since 1961.
Well, I've been staff writer. I think my first piece appeared for them in 1959. That's right.
Did you ever worry that if you hadn't had that base and if your credentials as a writer hadn't already been established, that it might have been hard to get your autobiographies published?
Oh, absolutely. It's already hard. I think we are now coming into an age when everything is the marketplace, and the kind of writing I do is so specialized and so much depends on formal prose and reading carefully. That kind of reading television has destroyed. People now, even editors, read, and they don't read the way I read. They just skim over something. They get an idea, and basically what they're looking for, is this a marketable subject? So, some of my autobiographical volumes had to be published by Oxford University Press because I couldn't get commercial publishers to publish them. And now they are being reestablished in paperback by a commercial house, which I'm delighted about.
You spend so much of your time remembering your past so that you could piece it together for the series of autobiographies that you're writing. And I think for a lot of us, there's something liberating to forget our past, because by forgetting your past, you forget about all the mistakes that you made, all the stupid things that you've said, all the pain that you've experienced. Do you ever wish that you didn't have to do all that remembering for your work?
No, because I think that people who live without sense of past are no better than animals. They might as well be dogs, as far as I'm concerned. I think what makes a human being different from all the animals is obviously speech, but more importantly, it's the memories. It's the history of their own lives. And people, they may say they're trying to forget it, but I think it determines your life. You may forget it, but your unconscious doesn't, and that determines your conduct all the time.
Ved Mehta, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me here.
My guest has been Ved Mehta. He's written several autobiographical books about growing up blind in his native India and then moving to the United States. His book, Vedi, was recently published in paperback by Norton. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Randall Robinson. He's one of the founders of the Free South Africa movement in the United States, so I hope you can join us. Pianist Bill Evans playing Elsa on Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, historian Michael Ignatieff uses the tools of his trade to research his own family genealogy, and he considers our recent obsession with discovering our roots. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the reissue of the 1959 album Ellington Jazz Party. He also examines a new controversial biography of Duke Ellington that argues his talents as a composer have been overrated. And television critic David Bianculli continues his rundown of the new fall season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Dale Willman in Washington. A British tanker has been attacked and set on fire in the northern Persian Gulf, according to shipping sources there. The attack apparently was carried out by Iranian gunboats operating off an Iranian-held island, and it comes the same day President Reagan told United Nations delegates that Iran should observe a U.S.-sponsored ceasefire proposal in the Persian Gulf War.
I know that the president of Iran will be addressing you tomorrow. I take this opportunity to call upon him clearly and unequivocally to state whether Iran accepts 598 or not. If the answer is positive, it would be a welcome step and major breakthrough. If it is negative, the Council has no choice but rapidly to adopt enforcement measures.
Reagan was making his sixth annual appearance before the General Assembly. He also announced that he was heartened by new prospects for improvement in relations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. That optimism, he said, is the result of a possible treaty between the two superpowers, which would get rid of all short- and medium-range nuclear missiles. A former Republican cabinet member today urged the Senate to reject the nomination of Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. William Coleman was Transportation Secretary under Gerald Ford. Coleman told the Senate Judiciary Committee today that Bork is unfit to serve on the High Court because of his record on civil rights and personal liberties.
Having come this far towards a free and open society, we should not stop or turn back the constitutional development that slowly and steadily is removing the vestiges of 350 years of legally enforced racial discrimination and of centuries of irrational discriminations against women.
The Judiciary Committee heard 5 days of testimony from Judge Bork last week. This week it will hear from a number of groups and individuals who will testify on the Bork nomination. Among those who support Bork are the American Conservative Union and the National Right to Work Committee. Health and Human Services Secretary Otis Bowen today spelled out the Reagan administration's objection to a bill that would expand AIDS testing. Bowen says he opposes sections that would ensure confidentiality and bar discrimination against people infected with the AIDS virus. Bowen told a House subcommittee today that the states are working out their own legislation in those areas. At the White House, spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the administration believes the states have preemptive responsibility to provide safeguards for privacy and fair treatment. Illinois Governor James Thompson today approved a bill that requires AIDS tests for couples who want to marry and mandates tracing the sex contacts of AIDS victims. The legislation also gives the state limited power to quarantine AIDS victims. Thompson also approved strict confidentiality measures for AIDS testing and treatment. Thompson's action caps 6 months of debate, which generated emotional protests and a threat by some lawmakers to oust the state's public health director. The head of the Federal Aviation Administration has ordered a safety review of U.S. plane manufacturers. UPI's Kate Murphy has details.
Federal Aviation Administration Chief T. Allen McCarter is ordering a special review of the nation's aircraft manufacturing industry. McCarter says no specific incident prompted the unusual investigation, but adds there have been some unauthorized bogus parts used in planes in recent years, which could pose a problem if unchecked.
We're not doing this because we have some alarm that has said we got a real problem, let's see if we can fix it, and we're not going to let you know about it.
The review will involve an in-depth check of a selective cross-section of about 40 of the 1,300 firms involved in making aircraft and components. Kate Murphy, Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 31 points to close at 2,492. You're listening to National Public Radio News. I'm Dale Willman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. 4 years ago, James Lincoln Collier wrote a critical biography of trumpeter Louis Armstrong. It came under fire from those who said the book unfairly dismissed Armstrong's later career. Now Collier has written an even more controversial biography of Duke Ellington. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has some thoughts on Collier's new book and on a recent reissue of a 1959 Ellington album. From that album, this is an excerpt from Timperturbably Blue.
James Lincoln Collier's new critical biography of Duke Ellington has just been published by Oxford, and it's both admirable and exasperating. Collier's analyses of the composer's early work are frequently brilliant. He puts himself inside Duke's head to see how the three-minute classics of the 20s and 30s were put together. And he focuses on Duke's delight in breaking the rules as a key to his genius. In the American tradition, his Ellington is a tinkerer, making subtle changes in established structures until the end result sounded nothing like its inspiration. But Collier can be a stern judge as well. He's been tactless and frank enough to point to the vulgarity in much of Ellington's later music. Still, the book's infuriating. Collier rightly maintains that Duke's best work was done before the mid-40s, but he's too quick to dismiss everything that came after. By mid-century, Ellington's penchant for grouping instruments in novel ways was so ingrained he made fascinating music even when working on blatantly commercial projects. Case in point is a 1959 session recently reissued by Columbia as Ellington Jazz Party. Notable for guest appearances by Dizzy Gillespie and blues shouter Jimmy Rushing, it's neither the best nor worst of Duke's later albums. It was, in part, a gimmick record. Its original title was Ellington Jazz Party in Stereo. For two tracks, nine percussionists were arrayed from far left to far right in front of the microphones to demonstrate the glories of stereo separation. It was a silly idea, and it sounds it. You can't fault Collier for ignoring baubles like these. And yet, even when working with the simplest materials, Ellington's knack for striking contrast saves the day. Red Carpet Part 3, a section of the so-called Toot Suite, is no more than an elementary blues built on a clarinet-dominated, brazenly simple background riff. But listen to the way that riff builds in intensity as it frames the talking trumpet of Rain Ants. The contrast between muted brass and bright clarinets is dramatic.
Thank you. These days, we'd call red carpet's simple structure minimal. But then minimalism is old news in the jazz world, emerging most clearly in the work of pianists famous for playing a few notes, Count Basie, Thelonious Monk, or Duke himself. In his Ellington biography, Collier also sells short the last great soloist to join the band, tenor saxophonist Paul Gonsalves. Because he specialized in marathon high-energy solos in which he endlessly paraphrased some basic theme, he's usually dismissed as a one-trick pony, a cheap showman. But one might instead look at Paul Gonsalves as a minimalist too, reaping a maximum of effect from the skimpiest of materials. Ready Go, which concludes that toot suite, is one of numerous up-tempo romps Duke wrote for him, in hopes of recreating the excitement of Paul's epic performance at the 1956 Newport Festival. And as ever, Gonsalves' light sound and unstoppable momentum are somehow perfect for each other. The routine was an old one, but Paul makes it sound newly minted, which is not much different from what Duke was doing, reliving old triumphs, but still making his music sound fresh. If he'd fallen from the heights of previous decades by 1959, he still stood head and shoulders above virtually any composer for big band writing then, or now.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat, Cadence, and Jazz Times magazines. He reviewed James Lincoln Collier's new biography of Duke Ellington and a reissue of the album Ellington Jazz Party. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer and historian Michael Ignatieff. He's written a book about his aristocratic family called The Russian Album. It's an opportunity for Ignatieff to examine how our family history shapes our personal identity. Ignatieff is descended from Russian counts, princesses, generals, and diplomats. His paternal grandfather, Paul, was the Minister of Education in the last cabinet of Tsar Nicholas II, and his grandmother, Natasha, was a princess. The family fled Russia during the Revolution and eventually settled in Canada, where Michael was born. I asked him to explain how his search began.
When I was about 16, I realized that my grandmother, a woman who died 2 years before I was born, had left memoirs of her childhood on great Russian estates in the 19th century, of meeting my grandfather in Nice on a winter's holiday at the turn of the century, of her life on an estate in the Ukraine before the First World War, of her eyewitness accounts of the 1905 revolution, and then the great deluge of the First World War and the revolution itself. And these memoirs, which were sort of 350 jumbled pages that she typed out on the backs of recipes and cornflakes boxes and all this kind of stuff, were in a tremendous pile in the attic. And one day, as these things happen, I just began to read, and I had a sense of being entranced by a vanished voice. For many people, that's how the search for a past begins. You hear this voice beyond the grave and you start trying to give them life.
Well, you point out in your book that a lot of people have backgrounds that they don't really want to talk about or to admit to. What kind of backgrounds were you thinking of? Friends who you know maybe who didn't really want to talk about their backgrounds.
I think the most poignant people in a way that I've met are people who have just essentially happy suburban pasts, you know. They're just what they're ashamed of, they shouldn't be ashamed of, but they're ashamed of the fact that they're just so ordinary, that they don't provide a dramatic story. And I always felt as a child that, you know, exile and expatriation, having lost anything, had its problems. But one of the things that it definitely did have was a certain kind of raffish glamour. And I've certainly benefited from that. I feel that's an enormous privilege.
Have you ever been uncomfortable about your past, though? I don't know what your politics are, but being the descendants of people who helped lead the Tsarist rule might not be the most comfortable thing.
It's a very good question, Terry. I've been very uncomfortable about it in one particular respect, is that the Tsarist tradition is notoriously anti-Semitic. And one of the things that I felt was rather passed over in silence in my immediate relatives' encounter with their past was the anti-Semitism. The fact that my great-grandfather was the author of the special legislation against the Jews in 1881, which many historians regard as the precipitating factor in the huge Jewish migration from Central and Eastern Europe that begins in the 1880s, and which brings millions of Eastern European Jews to America. And I felt I had to go in search of that past, the unpleasant past, the vicious past, as well as the happy, sentimental, nostalgic past.
That leads to another question, which is how responsible are you, as anyone, for any evils perpetrated by their ancestors?
Oh, I think you are. I think you're very definitely responsible for the truth. You'd be behaving irresponsibly if you paraded around telling your grandchildren or your great-grandchildren this was a spotless, blameless past, that your great-grandfather was a, you know, loved Jews, respected the Jewish people. He emphatically did not. And I think you are responsible for the truth, however painful. And if you fail that responsibility, what you're doing is you're spreading lies, and history shouldn't be about lies.
You've written that the more you got to know the historical story of your grandfather, the more he was lost to you personally as a grandfather. Would you explain that contradiction?
Yes, I'm not sure I can. It's just a feeling I have that there's a contradiction between what history can tell us about a person and what we want to know about them. The grandfather I want is the smell of his clothes, how he lit his pipe, how he brushed his few remaining hairs off the top of his head when he was irritated, how he read a book, how he sang his Ukrainian songs. You think that by pursuing a person's historical specificity, you get them somehow. All you get is the kind of social shell within which the real person resides. That's what I meant.
Those are strong words coming from a historian.
I know. It's a great surprise to me. I'm a passionate rationalist as well. I'm passionately devoted to the value of history. But I think you have to be very stoic or very clear in your mind about what it is that you can get from the search for the past, the reconstruction of the past. Because what's coming between you and the historical subject you seek is mortality. It's death. You can't cross that gulf. I feel I've kept an obligation to those people. That is, I have been faithful to them, as they, I hope, would wish me to be. But I can't say that I've recreated them in all their vividness. I've tried with all the tricks that one uses, but I still feel that if my grandmother were to pick up my book, she'd read it and close it with a little ironic smile and say, "That was an interesting little fairy story you just told." You see, I don't think I would. I think she would feel the distance between herself, her real self, and the self that I've managed to portray.
Most people who do family research do it to learn something about themselves, in addition to learning about their past. Do you feel like you learned something about yourself in doing this research?
It's hard to say. I'm sure it made me much closer to the Russian side of my nature. It brought me much closer to a certain kind of ineradicable melancholy, which seems to kind of haunt me in a way. I think, obviously, in some other sense, one writes to free oneself of things, to get free of things. I feel now that I know as much as I can know about that part of my past, and it somehow leaves me freer to go on and be, you know, a dad, a writer, a guy making his living in the latter half of the 20th century. I think it's that thing that's wonderful about writing and very unexpected. Writing is a tremendous act of emancipation, and I feel the emancipation from it.
Is there any one story or any one point about your grandparents that you're especially glad you found out about?
That's an interesting question. I'm very struck by things that one would not expect from, you know, white Russian aristocratic people of enormous wealth and privilege, which is not merely that they were courageous, because lots of courage isn't distributed according to wealth and income, but simply that they didn't have regrets. They didn't look back with a kind of haunted nostalgia for the Russian past. What is most extraordinary to me about them, and you see it in their sons, is that they didn't sit there with their bags packed waiting for history to go a different way. Once the revolution had occurred, they adapted very quickly to their fate, and they never complained about their fate. And so the image that a lot of people have of white Russian aristocrats sitting in cafes near the Orthodox Church, only speaking Russian, whining and drinking vodka and complaining about the cruel fate that history has dealt them, is simply untrue in the case of my grandparents. They said to their children, "You're in a new world. You've got to get a technical education. You've got to learn a skill. You've got to learn English. You've got to get on with it." And I find that tremendously admirable in my grandparents.
In that respect, you're very much related to your grandparents, that you too are not overly devoted to the past.
Well, I think you have to do a neat trick. You have to pay the past reverence, and you have to work yourself free of it.
Michael, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure, Terry.
Michael Ignatieff is the author of The Russian Album, published by Viking. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, we're following the president's speech to the UN General Assembly in New York. Jim Angle will have a report on what's become a kind of an annual State of the World message by the president.
The Bork hearings entered a new phase today.
That's right. The nominee wrapped up, but his supporters and opponents are now appearing before the committee. We'll also have an interview with Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, as a Republican on the committee and a swing vote. And also a report about 20 years after the long, hot summer of 1967, the legacy of that season of urban riots and what impact they've had on American urban life today.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new fall television season officially begins this week. Our TV critic David Bianculli has the good news and the bad news, along with some insights into the latest trends in programming.
Most of the new shows premiering this week look a lot alike, like suspects in a police lineup. But three of them are refreshingly different. CBS's Tour of Duty, which premieres Thursday opposite The Cosby Show, is TV's first weekly drama about the Vietnam War. That in itself makes it significant, and a TV curiosity worth checking out. The other different new shows are both from ABC, and both premiere on Wednesday. There's Hooper Man, which stars John Ritter and is from the makers of L.A. Law. Then there's the Slap Maxwell story, starring Dabney Coleman of Buffalo Bill. Slap Maxwell comes from Jay Tarsis, who did The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd. And Slap is just as promising. There are quirky, intelligent characters, good acting, clever writing, and no laugh track. Here's Slap, who's just been fired from his newspaper job as a sports columnist, talking about his future to his friend the bartender.
You know, actually, this might be the best thing that could happen to me. New lease on life. It's a big world out there, you know. Sky's the limit. There's a bus called Destiny out there waiting for me, and I'm going to ride it right down the highway to tomorrow.
Six cliches in 10 seconds.
Was it six?
Takes your breath away.
Yeah, it does. But if you're waiting for the same sort of cleverness from the other new shows this week, don't hold your breath. The biggest trend this week, and this year, is that there's no longer any attempt to portray a normal two-parent family in a sitcom. The Cosby Show and Family Ties have basically cornered that market, so the networks have scrambled to come up with variations on the theme. The results aren't very funny, but they are instructive. Let's say you're a young man, and all of a sudden you're a widower, or for some reason are instantly responsible for raising one or more kids without the help of a wife. Last year, this might have been the plot of a dramatic TV movie. This year, it's so common a situation that you'd have your choice of fun options. What's a father to do? In Full House, you get your two best friends to move in and help. In My Two Dads, you get one ex-best friend to move in. And in I Married Dora, you get the housekeeper to move in and marry her. You don't have to have a death in the family to build a bigger family, though. According to Everything's Relative, you can make ends meet by moving in with your brother. Which makes sense, because one of last year's new series was My Sister Sam, in which a young woman made ends meet by moving in with her sister. And in Mama's Boy, a series that premiered last week, Nancy Walker plays a mom who moves in with her full-grown bachelor son. Inheritances are big this season, too. In Frank's Place, the hero inherits a restaurant. In Hooper Man, the hero inherits an apartment building. And one of those yappy, disgusting little dogs. And in My Two Dads, the heroes inherit a 12-year-old daughter. Finally, the other notable trend this season is interior decorating. For some reason, maybe because all of the producers saw the movie Nothing in Common last year, a lot of shows have basketball courts inside somebody's house. Now, in real life, basketball courts inside the house are about as common as three best friends raising some kids. But on TV, there are indoor hoops on The Oldest Rookie, Full House, and a couple of other shows. I can't remember which ones, though. Like I said, they all tend to look alike after a while.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with crime writer Elmore Leonard. His new novel, Touch, is a departure from the writing that made him famous. It was actually written 10 years ago, but wasn't published until after the success of his novels Glitz and Bandits. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will give the story behind Chuck Berry's biggest hit, Maybelline. And book critic John Leonard will review two new novels by two young authors, The Rules of Attraction by Bret Easton Ellis and From Rockaway by Jill Eisenstadt. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Research assistants from Sue Spolin. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.